Welcome to the very first international version of Bombshell, combined with my first Bombshell / Women in the National Security podcast. I am here at the Kingston Conference on International Security with an amazing set of guests, but this is just Lauren this week. I'm here solo. I don't have Aaron or Radha. They did not feel free to cross the Canadian border because apparently we're at war with Canada right now.
Fair.
It's a little awkward, so I had to risk being on the other side of the border as skirmishes begin. The conference is a two-day event diving into complex national security issues every year. It's got a lot of insights from a lot of very smart people, but at the end of the day, it was a lot of wonks talking about deterrence among themselves. So we wanted to have a podcast taking the concept of deterrence and explaining it to a broader audience and using a couple of different ways to talk through deterrence in terms of pop culture, in terms of how you educate senior leaders, and also to think about how people bring different perspectives to this issue. And I have, as I said, a fabulous set of guests. Elaine Bunn is the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Nuclear Missile Defense Policy at the Pentagon, former Pentagon wonk like me. Stephanie Von Hlacki is the Director of the Center for International and Defense Policy at Queen's University. And Stephanie Carbon, who is also a podcast co-host, is an assistant professor at the Patterson School of International Affairs at Carleton, and she is a co-host of a podcast called Intrepid. So, welcome, ladies. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Yeah.
I'm most excited. I have to tell everyone that we have the most enormous mimosas I have ever seen in my life.
If you were coming to
Canada,
goblet
size.
Yeah, we were going to do this right, and unfortunately, we couldn't do it. I thought it was a little early for beer. But
it is, I don't want to tell you quite how early it is in the morning that we are consuming mimosas, but it will be
it's a morning drink.
Tremendous addition to my own remarks at the conference later today on how deterrence is actually probably been practiced in defense policy. So instead of our usual bombshell questions, I'm going to go through a couple of deterrence-focused ones, because that's the theme of the conference. My first one, which I'm most excited about, you guys probably focus more on this than on actual substance for this last 2 days, is what movie has the most to teach us about deterrence? Stephanie Carbon, you can go first.
Oh, goodness.
You have notes.
I do have notes. And yes, you're correct. I spent more time on this than any substantive question. So I was thinking pretty hard about this, and you have like the classic movies about the Cold War, but and the first one that comes to mind is obviously Dr. Strangelove and Failsafe, which are actually the original films, which are two of my favorite movies. But the one I want to highlight is actually, I'm actually stealing this from Professor Steve Sademan, who's also here at the conference. But he uses this in his teaching, and I've mercilessly stolen it, which is Footloose.
Wow.
Footloose.
I'm going to need an explanation.
Yeah. So you're thinking, why? So there's a scene in the film where there's two tractors. It's a game of chicken. And they're on the two tractors. And the two tractors are heading towards each other. Mm-hmm. And it's about who dodges out first, right? Mm-hmm. And that's essentially what deterrence is, right? It's about, trying to force the other guy to blink. And so it really is this kind of scene where there's Kevin Bacon, who is, being Kevin Bacon on the tractor. He has to learn how to drive a tractor. It's really interesting because there's a lot of layers to this because he doesn't actually know what he's doing.
Right.
Right? It's his first time driving a tractor. So, and they're having to show him how to work the tractor. The other guy, he's high on pot, right? But he doesn't actually communicate this to the other side.
Right.
So he's unpredictable, but we don't know this. Right. And then so Kevin Spacey and the other guy, whose name I haven't bothered to learn, are heading towards each other. Kevin Bacon's shoelace gets caught in the brake. So he can't actually turn. He can't actually veer off. And he has to go through with it. It doesn't matter. And then in the end, the other guy chickens out. But, there's this whole thing. There's people watching. So there's audience costs to all of this. So I actually think this is the greatest scene of deterrence in cinematic history.
I think Thomas Schelling should have just quit his job early as soon as Footloose came out and just let this be the greatest lesson.
I think, that scene is set to one of the greatest songs of all time, which is Bonnie Tyler's I Need a Hero. There's nothing wrong with that scene.
Not for us, Stephanie.
I will not. The podcast listeners have suffered enough. But yes, so that was my choice.
All right, Elaine.
Well, okay, I immediately thought of Dr. Strangelove. I have to admit, I've given it as going away presents many times to colleagues.
Really?
But hey, I'm the one here who is no longer in a job. You know, I've did 40 years in this business. I am now free at last. And so, you know, I go back a ways, and I actually saw Dr. Strangelove in, well, maybe not in the theater, but I've seen it a number of times. And yeah, a lot of my colleagues at when I was at National Defense University used it as a teaching tool. Mm-hmm. You know, no fighting in the war room. There are just many pieces of that. And part of it is the uncertainty about what's even going on. You know, you don't even know what's going on. The president's there. He doesn't know what all the underlings are doing out there. And that really, I think, says a lot about the uncertainty of deterrence. So, yeah, okay, I'll go with the classic.
Okay, fair.
Stephanie.
I'm starting to think that we should have a seminar called Deterrence Through Film.
Indeed. There's one. Great. National Defense University did it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There's one that was taught.
Americans always leading the way in all things deterrence.
Well, and a lot of people signed up for it because there wasn't a lot of reading. They could just watch
movies.
But no, good discussion. It was actually, I didn't teach it, but it was a great discussion that came out of it. International crowd, too.
Yep. I'll steal that idea. So mine is 13 days, and it might seem like an obvious answer, mm-hmm. but I also use it in the classroom. I don't think it's Kevin Costner's best role, to be perfectly honest.
Well, he totally nails that accent. It's great. He was a very convincing New Englander.
But I think that it's tricky to explain bureaucratic politics to students sometimes, and that movie does that really well. It really shows how various members of government and the military are pushing for their own set of goals mm-hmm. and objectives, and you see that pushing and hauling, which I think is really interesting. It also tells us a lot about crisis decision making and just the sheer stress that people are under and how that can circumvent the time that you have to make rational decisions, right? Mm-hmm. And finally, it tells us a lot about civil-military relations. And at the time, you had, I think, a lot of mistrust mm-hmm. between President Kennedy and the military establishment. Mm-hmm. And the military certainly wasn't a source of restraint in this particular case. Mm-hmm. Moving up to today, it seems that the situation is a little bit different, where mm-hmm. military generals often seem like they're a source of restraint when mm-hmm. considering forceful options. So yeah, 13 days is a good one for me, and I constantly use it in my classes.
Can I just add to that? I think the other thing it shows really well is how misinterpretations or accidents can escalate quickly.
Right.
And I think that's also a really important. I really love that movie, so I think that was good. I think both those are good choices too.
And also how personal relationships tend to matter, or accidental personal relationships tend to matter a lot in policymaking, which is something we don't like to acknowledge too much. But at the end of the day, if you understand the words that somebody is using and you don't understand somebody else's terminology, it's going to make a big difference in who you trust more than anyone else in the room.
Well, for all the talk about the capabilities and the stuff of deterrence,
right.
it's really
emotional.
About human beings, mm-hmm. right? It's mm-hmm. about decisions in the minds of adversaries and so forth. So it's about the human element more than we like to admit sometimes.
It's about Kevin Bacon.
It is about Kevin Bacon on a tractor.
I just wanted to dance.
Uh-huh. Speaking of dancing, if deterrence had entrance music,
ooh,
what would it be?
Ooh.
All right, Elaine, okay. You're excited.
Okay, no, I am, because I said this yesterday in my talk. The great strategist Sting.
Yes.
Every move you make, every step you take, and adversaries and friends are watching you. And
oh.
It really makes.
Well done.
Look, your actions speak. And everyone is watching what you do with everyone else. So it's not about a stalker. It's about deterrence.
Right. Okay? So I'll be watching you by the police.
It's
the police, I think.
Okay. Google. That's what Google's for.
Yep,
sorry,
exactly.
Guys.
It's the same thing. It's the same thing.
I think he was. Yeah,
tell that to the police.
He's still,
that
still,
aren't Sting.
He still performs it.
Right.
It's still deterrence regardless.
Yes.
All right, Stephanie.
Which one?
Yeah, how about you, since I went first last time?
When you say that question, I hear Darth Vader's theme song.
Yes.
I can't help it. Mm-hmm. And yesterday at the conference, Jeffrey Larson said deterrence is nasty business.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is why that theme song comes to mind. And if you're stuck in a nuclear crisis, I think that's what the adversary looks like to you. So, yeah, I can't help but have that dun 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 dun.
Right.
Even though I haven't seen all the Star Wars movies.
This is going to be bad.
Really bad.
I'm going to get a bad.
The next act crowd.
It's my sabbatical project.
It's a sabbatical project.
So I spent the most time on this question.
Uh-huh, as well, you should.
It's a great question. And what I decided was that actually most songs about deterrence are actually about deterrence failure.
Okay. Yes.
Right. So the consequence of deterrence failure. So, I mean, you can go like right back to the 80s. I don't know if many people are familiar with this. This is a song, Ultravox, as a band called Ultravox. So Dancing with Tears in My Eyes, which is about basically everyone dying in a nuclear explosion. 99 Red Balloons, which is also about everyone dying in a nuclear explosion. Uh-huh. Christmas at Ground Zero, which is about everyone dying in a nuclear explosion, but at Christmas. And then I thought, actually, is My Boyfriend's Back? That's about deterrence failure.
She
failed to deter him, but now she's like, my boyfriend's back, and he now has to execute the punishment.
The punishment. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yes.
But I think, okay, so, and then it came down to, okay, well, is there songs about, like, non-deterrence failure about deterrence, mm-hmm. right? So I think the appropriate song would be Russians by Sting. Because it's about a countervalue target. I hope the Russians love their children too. Right? I hope so. If they love their children, they won't engage in nuclear war. So that's essentially about mutually assured destruction.
So apparently, Sting is a deterrent strategist, and we just didn't know.
One knew.
Wow.
Right. So that's what I was asking about that.
Sting and the police.
Okay. Sting and the police. Okay.
Yeah, so we're both right.
So okay. Stephanie Carvin has a playlist.
I put a lot of thought into this. But the only problem with the Russian song is it's really a bad song. I don't like the song. So I picked, in the end, Two Tribes by Frankie Goes to Hollywood. Because that's just a great song. I don't know if it's the best song. It's just a great song.
I honestly, when I wrote this question, I was like, it was on a whim. I thought like, oh, we'll see how the answers go. I had no idea that I would end up with a deterrence playlist to spread far and wide.
I wonder, can we put that on Spotify?
Yeah.
We should
do absolutely
that.
Put this on Spotify.
Okay.
All right. So a little more seriously, before I get into the actual substantive questions, Stephanie, we decide 2.0, you're 1.0?
Yeah, I like to think of Stephanie von Halaki, and I always say this and embarrasses her, but it's true. She's the tenured, more qualified, better looking, smarter, and grant-getting Stephanie. And I'm the other one.
I'm going to need more mimosas.
You can just call me the other Stephanie.
The other Stephanie.
The other Stephanie.
Steph with an F, Steph with a
the
B-H.
PH. Yeah.
Steph, okay.
Steph C.
Steph with an F. How did you choose the topic for this conference? We are spending 2 days focusing on deterrence. We're a bunch of nerds and just like absolutely delighting in our wonkitude right now. But it's become something that you actually hear more about on the news these days. Mm-hmm. It's more on like the minds of folks who don't focus on deterrence day to day. How did this become the theme?
Yeah, I think the fact that it is more and more in the news, and the fact that I think there's a danger of public misconceptions when it comes to that term, is exactly why we felt the need to include it as a conference theme. At the same time, every year when we pick a conference theme, it's the result of intense deliberations mm-hmm. between our partners. So there's the Queen's mm-hmm. Center for International Defense Policy or in a university setting, and then our other three partners are what you would call practitioners. So representatives from the NATO Defense College, representatives from the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, and Canadian Army partners through the Canadian Army Doctrine and Training Center right here in Kingston. And so we get together usually a little bit before we have a conference, and we think about the theme for the next year, because we have a 365-day planning cycle. And there are several blurbs that are written. We debate about it, and eventually we pick a theme. And deterrence is one that resonated from a Canadian perspective, from an American perspective, and, of course, from a NATO perspective. And knowing also that the NATO summit is coming up mid-July, it struck us as a very important theme to really do a deep dive into. Now, we didn't know we would have the amazing timing that we had.
That's
because
true. You could not have picked a better time.
You could not.
The Trump-Kim summit happening at the same time as the Kingston Conference is something, obviously, that we couldn't have predicted, and just ended up being perfect timing for the conference, and really great for the discussions during the breaks, right?
So I want to get back to a concept that you mentioned in there about public conceptions and misconceptions about deterrence. And, it, you know, as elites have debates about what deterrence requires and what deterrence is and what the goals of deterrence are, it's a concept that's always fascinated me because it requires a lot of public trust. Mm-hmm. I think I was born in 1981, so I kind of vaguely recall discussions about mutually assured destruction and what nuclear weapons were and thinking, why are we trusting that these vulnerabilities that we are ourselves maintaining vis-a-vis the Russians or the Soviets at the time are actually going to work? Like, why do we have this trust in our government and in the Soviets? And it is, as a five-year-old, I probably didn't use the term vulnerabilities, deterrence, or mutually assured destruction, but I still remember it being pretty freaking scary. Mm-hmm. So, Elaine, in particular, I'm curious about what all you guys think. How does public trust, public understanding of deterrence, how does that, should that factor more into how we are talking about it? What are some of the misconceptions that the public has about deterrence?
Yeah, you're talking about, as a five-year-old, what you thought. Mm-hmm. Why am I in this business? I'm not sure. Well, mm-hmm. An internship with Senator Sam Nunn was part of the reason. But, I mean, it actually goes back. I was 9 years old when my baby brother was born. Mm-hmm. It was October of 1962.
Oh, goodness.
You know, yep. that was, yep, right in the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Mm-hmm. I'm at my grandmother's, you know, while my baby brother's being born, thinking, watching President Kennedy on TV and thinking, isn't it too bad that my baby brother will never get to grow up? Because we're all going to
die.
Yep.
I mean, wow. What a moment.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Wow. And yes, I was doing the duck and cover at school as well. Mm-hmm. So that moment in history when we all worried about the big one, the big, right, exchange, the massive arsenal exchange, and then the end of the Cold War. And so I think the public sort of thought, we don't have to worry about that anymore.
Right.
This is just not something we have to worry about, and we'll go about our business. And right, terrorism. Well, but nuclear weapons still exist in the world, mm-hmm, in the hands of countries that we may have problems with. So it's really that that problem of, I think it's more in the news now with North Korea, mm-hmm, and so forth, maybe somewhat with Russia. But that idea that, I used to tell my kids when they were little, what does mommy do for a living? Well, mommy's job is to try to help make sure that no really big wars happen. And as they got older, and if they do that, they're not as bad as they could have been.
Right.
They're not as bad as they could have been. So I think if the public kind of reads the headlines and says, oh, wait a minute, somebody must be out there trying to help make sure no really big wars happen. Mm-hmm. Then as they have interest in learning more and more about it, that you talk with them about it. People say, oh, well, I assume that you could talk about what you do, but you'd have to kill me. Well, no, actually,
you should talk
I can
about
talk
it more.
A lot about what, mm-hmm, I do. The details, the classified details are boring anyway. But the big picture of this, we ought to be talking about.
Yep.
Well, so I kind of focus on the misconception part of, mm-hmm, the question, and I think really I highlighted two that people tend to have on deterrence, and that is, first of all, that deterrence has to be like for like,
mm-hmm,
right? People think, oh, okay, and I think that's partially because all of our concepts probably mostly come from the nuclear, mm-hmm, discussions that we've had for generations, basically.
People think of it as like a duel, where I choose swords,
yes,
and you choose swords,
yes,
and I choose pistols, therefore I choose pistols.
Yeah, no, that's not how this works. I mean,
right,
ideally, if someone has a pistol, you want a more powerful gun.
Right, I want a cannon.
Yeah, essentially, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like you don't have to retaliate like for like. And I think the biggest example of this is cyber, where people, you know, we're now trying to apply concepts that were generated in the Cold War for kind of new kinds of threats that we're facing, whether it's disinformation campaigns or cyber and things like this. But with cyber, like the idea that you retaliate, okay, we've had a cyber attack, we have to retaliate with a cyber attack. No, that makes no sense. You know, we should be thinking about deterrence as, in terms of you know, sanctions, or is there other kind of political costs that we can put on people? So, I mean, not all, the cost you impose doesn't have to be equivalent to what you suffered.
Right.
Right. It can come out in different shapes or form. I think that's just a very basic misconception that's out there generally. The second thing I think that's out there, though, is that that deterrence has to be immediate. Right. Deterrence is something you can actually build up over time. And, you know, it's very hard to compel someone to do something right away. Well, compellence is different than deterrence. We can have a whole conversation about that. But I mean, if you're trying to deter someone, like, you know, from engaging in behavior, it might not happen right away. So, for example, again, the use of sanctions to try to deter someone from certain kinds of behavior, that's something that's probably going to take a number of years to interact. So I think the idea that deterrence has to be like for like, the idea that deterrence has to be immediate, these are probably two of the biggest misconceptions that are out there generally.
For me, it's the Cold War, post-Cold War distinction. And I like the fact that you brought up deck and cover, Elaine, because I think that during the Cold War, people felt they were at personal risk of this nuclear arms race. And today there are different types of school drills. It's lockdown, in case there's a school shooter, for example. So even though nuclear weapons haven't disappeared and they've been, the arsenals have been dramatically reduced since the end of the Cold War, if you look at what Russia and the United States are having, people have lost sight of the doomsday clock. And there are still thousands of nuclear weapons up there, and there are still some political tensions are still running quite high. But it's not on the public consciousness as it was during the Cold War. So I think this is a big change, and I think it's the reason why people just associate deterrence with the Cold War but may not appreciate how deterrence matters today, both because there are still nukes around, but also because there are different types of deterrence relationships. So it's not just between great powers anymore. You can have asymmetric deterrence relationships. And so I'm happy that we have this opportunity with this conference and this podcast to explore that a bit further. But I know that when I first introduced the concept of deterrence to my students and provide Cold War illustrations, they think it's a thing of the past. And then we look at the post-Cold War manifestations of deterrence and who has nukes, how many they have, and where they're located. And then all of a sudden it becomes real again.
Yeah, so it's not just about states. It's about non-state actors. It's about, you know, can you deter a terrorist group, which I think Schelling was looking at near the end of his life, right? So,
So you mentioned how this conference is incredibly well-timed. We had the G7 a couple days ago, the Singapore summit, where there will be no more nuclear threat from North Korea, apparently, just ended. And within just a few weeks, we're going into the NATO summit. It is summit season, apparently. It's like the big thing. We all need new wardrobes. So I wanted to use that as a chance. So President Trump obviously doesn't normally prep much for these sessions. He kind of takes pride in the fact that he's going to walk in and, like George W. Bush, look into somebody's eyes and be able to manage that relationship. I maybe am so slightly skeptical of that as a process Valentine. So I wanted to ask a question. If you could get President Trump to prepare for any of these meetings, ones that have happened before, we have the NATO summit coming up, and you could tell him anything and he would take it on board, or he would read anything and actually take it on board. I know that's a big step. He would actually read. What would it be?
I'm going to, I'll jettison the reading.
Yep.
I guess I would say...
It's hard. It's too hard to imagine that it would actually happen.
I would say my single piece of advice would be don't surprise your allies.
Yeah.
It takes a long time to build up, you know, the trust and credibility with those who have given up a little bit of their own leverage and they're trusting in you for the high end of the situation. And that's a relationship that you don't take lightly. We need allies are in our interest as well. And you don't surprise them. I mean, you can disagree with them, you can debate, you can have 7-month discussions to get to a few paragraphs, that's fine, but don't surprise them. And I'm afraid that I've seen that happening some lately.
If people have watched The Crown before, in the first season, one of the first secretaries says to someone in the royal family that royalty does not do improvisation. And it was one of those moments of like, yes, that is what diplomacy is. We do not do improvisation. We have processes, we have ways that we do business, and within those confines, we can be creative. But outside of those confines, you are in dangerous territory of people being like,
and spending far too much time trying to understand your intent rather than actually trying to come to some kind of agreement. But the Crown is another exceptional source of analogies for foreign policy. I highly recommend it, folks.
But I think that it gets back to Stephanie's choice of a film, 13 Days, where, you know, I think there's the representation of Robert McNamara, and he's like, look, this is language.
Right.
Everything we're doing here is language. Yep. This is how people interpret and understand what we're doing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, no, just to completely agree with what you're saying.
And what would your reading choice be?
Oh, God.
Stephanie Ph. Or advice. You can also do advice.
So what I came up with was chapter one of Arms and Influence, which is The Diplomacy of Violence. Mm-hmm. But I would have had an intern convert it to a coloring book.
Okay, that's a smart idea.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, get just, you know, some of those insights from Thomas Schelling. Mm-hmm. But in a coloring book. So, and maybe someone could do that generally. I'm sure there's a market for it.
There is absolutely a market for it. I mean, there's Clausewitz for Kids.
Right.
And a few other concepts like this. So, yeah, you could definitely make money off of this if you need to, as well as Brief the President.
Right.
So, it's actually rather Trumpian overall.
But I think what I would probably try to spend my time doing would be trying to explain, and I'm sure someone did try to explain this, and bless that person's soul, what CVID means, which is the complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization, because that message clearly did not get through. Mm-hmm. Like, and the reason that's important, that complete, so in other words, that you're completely getting rid of the nuclear weapons program, that you can verify that this has been done, that they can't reverse this, that, you know, there's no way for them to go back to this, and again, the denuclearization. That to me is the key concept that just didn't seem to register. The idea that Kim Jong-un was like, yeah, sure, and Trump's
totally
like, fixed it.
Yep.
Nailed it. You know, that to me suggests that maybe this will not end well in a couple months. But, you know, there's always the coloring book.
That's true.
Right.
So I have a self-help book, which I think might be really good in this particular context. And it's called Extreme Ownership. And it was written by two U.S. Navy SEALs, Jocko Willink and Leif Babin. And so in this book, you have lessons about leadership. Mm-hmm. And one of the key leadership lessons in the book is the ability to, with humility, accept that you've made mistakes and own up to it and take full responsibility for it. And I think that in Trump's, you know, quotables from the last couple of days or last 24 hours, you see, oh, well, if this isn't working, if it proves that Kim Jong-un can't be trusted, I'll have to admit I made a mistake. Or I probably won't admit I made a mistake and I'll probably find an excuse for it and so on. It goes a little something like this. But I think going into the NATO summit in July, and echoing what Elaine said about don't surprise your allies, I think a little bit of a mea culpa in this context. And he can do it very naturally. He can just say, you know, I've been difficult on you guys. I'm not going to say I'm sorry, but
I'm hard on you.
Yep. And I think we can move forward and just show a little bit of an opening because that the G7 was rough. The G7 was rough.
Oh,
and
boy.
It's okay to want to have a conversation about Russia and maybe should they be included back in, but you don't say so on the day of on television. You can have any idea that you'd like and you discuss it ahead of time. You can't paint people into a corner. So I would hope that he would read that book. He would take some lessons, and I brought a quote here. The best leaders are not driven by egos or personal agendas. And owning up to perhaps some mistakes that were made, I think, would be really, really constructive. Moving into a summit where you have 29 allies and where people look to the United States for leadership.
Now, to be fair to our allies, or to perhaps make them feel a little better, I think that also President Trump's staff would have liked to not be surprised by some of his statements that he's made in the last few days as well. So it's all a mutual surprise.
Mutually assured surprise.
Right. Exactly.
It's a whole new concept.
So getting back to Elaine's point at the beginning about how deterrence is very much about human relations, the human factor. It won't have escaped the notice of folks who are new to this podcast that everyone who is here talking today is a woman. And I think it's an important factor to talk about in policy, that people bring different perspectives, not only based on what school they went to, or are they in the military, are they civilians, but the background that they come from. And it's a tough concept to get into in specifics in public a lot of times. It's one of the reasons that in the Women in National Security podcast, we try to get into detail about how women's experiences in national security can sometimes be different, and their perspectives can sometimes be different, and not reject that as something to hide, but as something to highlight or at least consider. So the question we kind of get to on that issue is, how much does it matter? And you've all had wildly varying and very successful careers in national security. And I'm curious, for each of you, when did it first matter to you that you were a woman in this field?
Okay. Today is different than yesterday. Mm-hmm. 81. A meeting at NATO. It was obviously in the days of dual track decision, INF, mm-hmm. intermediate range nuclear forces, Pershing 2, GLICM, addressing the SS-20 deployment, all those good things. And it was a meeting of the special consultative group of NATO on the arms control side, but also did the high level group the other side. So, you know, it was kind of, I was definitely dual track. And I'm a presidential management intern graduate, and, mm-hmm. and I'm now a real DOD employee. And I'm at this NATO meeting, and I knew a whole lot about what was going on with the Russians, with the Soviets at the time, INF and so forth. And I was asked, basically, by several of our allies, the same question, but in different words. Mm-hmm. The German rep asked me, "What is your educational background?" The Greek representative asked me, "Why aren't you home having babies?" Was the same question, in essence. It was what are you doing here? Mm. That made me very aware, very aware that I was there and there was a Danish woman there and that was it.
Yep.
Very different now. It's very different now. And I mean, I often tell people that when I started in the Pentagon, there were three things that made me different. I was younger than most, mm-hmm. you know, just out of graduate school. And then I had never been in the military. So I was civilian, not mm-hmm. a civilian who was retired military. And the third thing was, I was a woman. That was the third of three differences. And it depended on the meeting and the day as to which one made the most difference. We all bring, you're right, we bring different perspectives from, where do we go to school, where do we grow up, did our mamas teach us to be nice to everybody? If you can't say something nice, just don't say anything. I'm a Southerner. All that comes into play.
Yeah.
I'm not one of those who says, well, if women ran the world, wouldn't it be great? And I go, gold in my ear, Maggie Thatcher, I mean, what do you want? But we all bring whatever background we have. Mm-hmm. And I used to say, being a mom actually was part of what I brought. But now I watch a lot of young dads who bring that to the table as well.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the first time I really became aware of my minority status as a woman mm-hmm. in the discipline was during my first conference, because you don't see it when you're a student in undergrad or even in your master's. There's still very much of a gender balance in your classrooms, even if you are studying international relations or security studies. But the first time I was part of a panel on nuclear weapons, and I got up there and did my presentation, and it dawned on me. I looked at the panel, my fellow panelists were all men, and 95% of the room also was male. And I remember in the front row, there were a few men sitting looking at me. And I could tell by the body language and the look on their face that their inner monologue said, "Oh, isn't that cute? Look at the little lady talking about bombs." And I thought, okay, I understand. I have to demonstrate my research findings, but I also have to prove my street cred. And it was immediately obvious to me at that moment. I think things have gotten better over time, and so for me, a buoy or a life jacket was my experience with women in international security. Mm-hmm. Not long after that moment at that conference, I saw this call to participate in a symposium in Washington, D.C. with the organization WISE, and I went there, and I saw that there were other women in this field, and it was just so great to share with these other women who were studying international security, but in different countries throughout the world, and to create that network.
So. For me, I mean, like, I think I've been through all of that experience. It hasn't really bothered me. I agree. There's the whole point of, like, it really is about being a woman in international security. What it is about proving your street cred. You know, I was in the government, but by and large, I was on a very women-dominated team looking at terrorism and government, and we worked really well together, and that was awesome. I think my first time where I actually felt it mattered was in academia, which is when students started coming up to me, and they're like, Stephanie, I really want to do my master's thesis on child soldiers in Africa. I'm like, okay, I don't know anything about child soldiers. I don't know anything about Africa. But I keep being asked to do these kinds of questions about children, and the rights of children. And I'm like, well, this isn't what I do. And actually, you know, it's interesting at Carleton, the person who said he teaches gender is actually a man, mm-hmm. Professor David mm-hmm. Long, who's fabulous. But, you know, so like people keep coming to me with this, and I'm like, well, no, I do the robots and the intelligence yep. and things like this. So it's kind of the expectations of what I study. And, you know, I keep being asked to participate in our development strategy. And I keep saying, you do not want me to participate in the development strategy, Canada, because I am the worst. I know nothing about this topic.
Our feminist assistance yeah, policy for which, our U.S. listeners.
Yeah, which has no new money, and we can that's like a whole other thing. I invite you to listen on Intrepid Podcast if you're interested in national security issues from a Canadian perspective. But yeah, so I think it's that, just the expectation of what you study. Yeah. The you know, and I have had young women come up to me and at conferences and basically say, you know, I've never seen a woman talk about artificial intelligence before. I've never seen a woman talk about technology or cyber before. And I didn't even think that was possible. That was shocking, actually, when I had women come up to me and say that. It's true. We're here, and we're, you know, I'm crazy and loud, and I'm trying to make a difference. And I would encourage women to study all these things. But it's kind of weird that just for me, that experience has been what people expect you to be interested in and not interested in.
Well, I want to follow up on that as our last question about the biggest misconception people have about women in the field, and then the prospects of increasing women in the national security field. And Stephanie and I were talking last night about how sometimes when I go to conferences, it is assumed that I am anti-military, anti-war. I went to a nuclear weapons conference, and clearly I was pro-ban treaty. Like, no, I hadn't had to explain that occasionally you do meet women in the field who know a little bit about how the military works and are not always opposed to deploying it in any way. And I have a group of women that we want to introduce a weekly steak night for all of us to go out who are, you know, not less slightly left-wing versions of the military field.
Involving steak? This sounds yeah, amazing.
Exactly.
I am in.
So, but as that, the biggest misconception people have about women in this field, like, what have you faced before?
I think a big misconception is that there are no women in the yep. field. And this is a question I often ask to conference organizers who don't feature women on their programs or who'll have manuals, all male panels. And I ask them, oh, it's interesting that there are only men on this panel. And they say, oh, we tried, but we couldn't find any women. And I can't help but think, really? Really, in the internet age, it's pretty yep. easy to find those female experts. And so I applaud initiatives like Women Also Know Stuff, mm-hmm. where you can register and be part of this network so that, you know, that excuse is not valid anymore. You are provided with, you know, binders full of women.
Online binders. Yeah. I would agree with that. I think some of the most successful conferences I've been to or organized or ones where, you know, we did take time, a little extra effort to find new voices. Mm-hmm. And that's just, new voices can be male or female. I don't want to say it's just women, but like, you know, trying to find more diverse panels means you're forcing yourself to find new people, mm-hmm. which usually makes for a better conference generally. And that's been my experience. And I think that's maybe one of the solutions here. It's not just going to the, look, I value experience, and Elaine, obviously you have experience. I'd buy you on my panels anyways, but to have just going out and forcing yourself to be like, okay, well, who else is writing on these things? Mm-hmm. And are they challenging conventional wisdom mm-hmm. and these kinds of things? And often you find out that is actually the case.
And the answer is they are.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. that's, I mean, you what will I say yes to immediately if it's mm-hmm. about next generation, and not just next generation as in college students mm-hmm. or just out of college, but there are a lot of people in there, you know, who have maybe 5-10 years of experience working these issues who are amazing mm-hmm. and they are thinking, yes, they have read all the traditional literature, they know that stuff, but they have taken it and said, but how does that apply to today?
Right.
You know, what is it that I want to take? What is it that we just need to leave behind? It was good then, but it doesn't apply to cyber and space and information warfare. It doesn't apply to those things, and it doesn't apply to multiple actors, and it doesn't. So there are some amazing folks out there. Some of them are female, some of them are male, mm-hmm. Some of them, you know, have this white skin, some of them don't have this white, you know, it's amazing. And so I would say, yeah, there are younger women. There's some, okay, there's some my age, and I have some colleagues that I respect a lot who are females. Then there's some who, you know, should have been Secretary of Defense, I'd say, Michelle Flournoy. Okay, and then there are people, there are a lot of younger women who are coming up who don't have the feeling of, oh, well, girls don't do bombs. Okay, no, they're not. Oh my God! They do anything they want to do.
Yeah. But this is where
and a lot of yeah. young men too. So
I was just gonna say, but this is where I think, you know, podcasts like this is really good to have, just, you know, women come in and talk about, you know, like Bombshell Podcasts, which is one of my favorite things. Just women coming in talking about the security issues is so important. And just so this is where just the visibility matters. It's not just having women on for women's sake. It's actually sending a message that yeah, you know what, you belong at this table, and you know our governments, respective governments, are going to be stronger if we have more diverse voices and we have people from a variety of experience. But they have to see themselves up there in the first place.
Right. And that's the other point. You know, we're talking about how to, you know, John Q. Public, and in democracies that matters, mm-hmm. is how does the public see these issues? You know, they do have elected representatives. They should be able to influence these issues. And if they see people who look like them, whatever it is they look like, if they see people who look like them who are doing those issues, I think that they are, it increases the interest level, and they, oh, I too can learn more about this. If I want to, I can work in this field. Yeah.
Ladies, thank you all for being part of the first cross-border international Bombshell Women in the National Security Space podcast. This has been delightful. I have now had, I think, the equivalent of like 7 mimosas in my goblet here. Thank you, Stephanie,
Stephanie keeps me filling.
I'm here to help.
And if you're new to the show, I hope you keep listening. Thank you.